This is Greg Corumbus of Radio America reporting for WorldNet Daily. My guest at this time is David Gardenstein-Ross. He is the Vice President of Research at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies here in Washington. We want to get his thoughts on a number of critical stories in the war on terror. First of all, what to call it, really, and how do we define the enemy? First, we want to get his thoughts, though, on the Al-Qaeda-related attacks in Uganda that killed as many as 74 people who were watching the World Cup final on Sunday. We also want to get his thoughts on Hamid Karzai, the Afghan president, looking to delist about 50 Taliban members from the UN's list. And David, it's always great to have you with us.
It's good to join you as well. And you set out a pretty ambitious agenda that I don't think we'll be able to cover the entirety of this morning.
That's probably not. Let's start with Uganda and obviously the horror there that an Al-Qaeda group known as Al-Shabaab is taking responsibility for. What do we know about this group and why do you think these folks were targeted in particular?
Al-Shabaab has been very open about its affiliation with Al-Qaeda, both its sympathy and also it has overlapping leadership with Al-Qaeda in East Africa. It's a group that emerged out of the insurgency in Somalia. Not that it only existed after Ethiopia invaded. It, in fact, pre-existed the Ethiopian invasion. But it really came to the forefront and became a very powerful fighting force during the course of the insurgency. Increasingly, it's been taking much more of a transnational vision. That is, not framing itself in terms of the territorial borders of Somalia, but looking out to the rest of the world, issuing statements describing its sympathy with Osama bin Laden and others. This is the first time, however, that Al-Shabaab has actually carried out an attack outside the borders of Somalia, which is cause for concern. When you look at the motivation of the attack, Shabaab has for some time been issuing threats against Uganda and also against Burundi because of the role of their troops in Somalia, where both countries are participating in the AMISOM mission, that is the African Union mission to Somalia, which sends peacekeeping forces to Mogadishu to try to stabilize the UN-recognized regime, that is the transitional federal government, against the Al-Shabaab attacks.
Given the relative lawlessness, given all the instability in Somalia, how much power does this group been able to build up over the years, and how much free rein does it have?
Shabaab has been able to build up a considerable foothold within Somalia. It's able to control territory there. Now, which territory is controlled by Shabaab, by its competitors, and by the transitional federal government changes on a day-to-day basis because a lot of the alliances within Somalia very rapidly shift. But it's clear that Al-Shabaab has been able to carve out a geographic foothold that it enjoys basically superior arms to that of the transitional federal government. If the African Union peacekeepers were to go away, the transitional government would not last very long and would certainly fall to Shabaab and to its other rivals.
Anything particular in this target, or just to point out, as you mentioned earlier, that they can strike outside of Somalia?
Well, the country where they struck, Uganda, is one thing that is significant about the target. They ended up striking in Uganda's capital city, Kampala, which shows their ability to strike at countries that are involved in the African Union peacekeeping. Another thing is this was striking at audiences who are watching the World Cup. And it's significant as well that one of the restaurants where they hit was an Ethiopian restaurant in the south of the city. Now, Ethiopia was the country that led the invasion of Somalia back in 2006. So I think the choice of target there is symbolic, and they were almost certainly trying to make sure that there were Ethiopians among the dead.
Well, let's move on now to Afghanistan, and of course that's been the source of a lot of renewed attention given the change in command in recent weeks. McChrystal is out, Petraeus is in, and now we see this report in the Washington Post today, David, that Hamid Karzai, the Afghan president, that our own administration has some misgivings about, to say the least, wants to remove about 50 Taliban figures from the UN blacklist, and the U.S. seems to be supportive of removing some but not all of these names. How significant is this?
In fact, the U.S. does seem to be supportive of removing all of these names. Richard Holbrooke has traveled to New York to meet with U.N. officials to try to press them to move forward on the delisting process, but the U.N. is quite skeptical of this, the reason being that U.N. officials say that they don't have sufficient information, that the people who Karzai wants to dislist have renounced violence, have broken with insurgents, have broken with Al-Qaeda, and taken the other steps that rectify the reason they were placed on the list in the first place.
is peeling off some of these names one of the better strategies to try and reduce the threat posed by the enemy that's obviously creating a lot of problems for us right now?
To be honest, it's unclear if this is the best strategy. It's unfortunate that in public discourse, often people's attitudes will solidify before they have enough information. The Washington Post story does not make clear who the 50 former officials are that Karzai wants to remove. It should be noted, a venerable tradition within Afghanistan of various factions to switch sides constantly. A lot of the fighting that occurs in the country is not ideologically based, but rather is based on different factions vying for power. They'll align themselves with whatever side seems to be winning. And what Karzai is trying to do is to take the reconcilables, that is, those who can be drawn into the government, not necessarily as participants, but at least as people who would enter into ceasefires with it, and bring those reconcilables into the fold. Now, one question you have at the outset is, are these really reconcilables as opposed to irreconcilables? And we don't have that information at this point in time. All we know is that there's about 50 people who Karzai wants to have delisted, and that he hasn't provided enough information to the UN to satisfy their concerns that they're really renouncing violence and are people who should legitimately be delisted. A second thing that strikes me as quite important, but that we don't know, is why isn't Karzai offering delisting as a bargaining chip to try to make them enter into ceasefires or be more amenable to the government. He hasn't even entered into talks with them yet, and he wants to delist them at the outset. It seems to me like he's potentially giving up a very valuable bargaining chip. Now, that being said, it obviously is not in his power to delist them. So it would be terrible if you were to overpromise and say, I can get you delisted if you do X, Y, and Z, and then not to be able to follow through. But it is a fact that he's looking for the delisting before he's gotten concessions out of the people whom he wants to talk to.
David, fascinating insight, and you're absolutely correct. We did not have enough time to talk about the debate over how to define the enemy in Afghanistan and elsewhere, but we'll get to that at another time very soon. As always, great to have you with us.
And it's great to join you.
David Gardenstein-Ross, Vice President of Research at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies here in Washington. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, reporting for WorldNet Daily.